Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silconet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Frank Algiano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David.
And we are still on strike when we're recording this, so we are recording this off-campus at our secret off-campus location, also known as my dining
room. No, don't tell them. We can't let the man know where we are.
Yes, if you UK is listening, we are on strike in protest of all kinds of things. We have a special guest this week. We're one of our rare special guest episodes, Joe Stoltz from Mount Vernon. So welcome, Joe. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're drinking tea and coffee this morning, not whiskey, because it's
9:15.
Yeah, 9:15, and you know, trying to do this properly. Joe, just to give everyone background, you are here in Scotland because you were giving a talk at the National Library a few days ago on your new book, Bloodless Victory, about the Battle of New Orleans, and you gave a talk last night, presented a paper at our American History Workshop on your new project on the relationship between the French and the rebels during the American Revolution. But we wanted to have you here on the show for a couple reasons. You know, one is because of your work at Mount Vernon and the ways in which the exciting things you're doing there, but also because a lot of our listeners are interested in, you know, doing public history and getting involved in public history. And, you know, Frank and I can both give them mediocre advice about how to do that, but we wanted to have somebody who actually has some much more hands-on experience than we do. So how did you get involved in public history and lead? So, you know, you might want to tell people what your job is.
Tell us about
like.
Yourself. We're speed dating.
Yes, we're speed dating.
So like any good historian, I'm going to go back to many years ago. When I was 16, I started actually volunteering at the Chalmette National Park, where the Battle of New Orleans is primarily commemorated, which is what then leads directly to why I wrote the dissertation in the first book I did. And so I started sort of early on just volunteering in public history. And then when I needed to pay the bills in undergrad, I got a job doing overnight tours on weekends on the USS Kidd, which is a World War II era destroyer in Baton Rouge. And so while most college undergrads in Louisiana were out carousing and drinking on the weekends, I was giving tours to 120 Cub Scouts and responsible for their safety on an old World War II ship with very few OSHA regulations on the Mississippi River, which was exciting.
Wild times in college, Joe.
Yeah, which was exciting and terrifying. But those juice boxes, man, you could hit the juice boxes. And so that was about 6 years. And then when I was working on my master's program in New Orleans, I couldn't do the drive all the way up to Baton Rouge on the weekend. So I started giving culinary history tours in the French Quarter,
nice.
Which were tasting tours. So that was about 10 pounds of weight gain those 2 years.
That sounds like a good job.
It was fun.
We should do that while we're on strike.
Yeah.
We should give
culinary history tours of Edinburgh. Right?
Yeah.
I think New Orleans has more to offer in that particular area.
Whiskey tasting tours.
When I went up to Fort Worth to go to TCU for graduate school, I did an internship the whole time I was up there at the Fort Worth Museum of Science and History. The only sort of formal public history education I ever got was at University of New Orleans. I did a minor in public history, which I think one of the sort of interesting things I'm always having to wrestle with when I get asked this question is, you know, also how do we even define public history? Because I know there's been some pushback from some folks in academia that say, well, every time I go into the classroom, I'm speaking to the public because my students are members of the public, which, yes, it's sort of an especially self-selecting group, though. Sure. So I think public history, to some extent, can kind of just be what you want it to be at this point. I don't know that at times it's defined itself very well. And so, like, the program I was in at University of New Orleans, the reason that the professor was sort of voluntold that they were going to do the public history class was because they had a background in documentary production, which was great, but it's also not the same thing as sort of museum exhibit creation. And so it kind of depends on, I think if anyone's interested in doing public history in a formal academic setting, like look really close at who those professors are mm-hmm. and what the sort of classes are to make sure that they are defining public history the way you're sort of especially interested mm-hmm. in approaching it. You know, if you're wanting to do more museum work or more documentary production, make sure that program actually focuses on that.
So as a practitioner, Joe, how would you define public history?
I mean, I think it's got to do, in some ways, sort of anything. I'll sort of do the reverse than most academics. I'll sort of say it's anything that isn't sort of straight traditional academic monograph driven or article driven history. So I'll sort of say it's everything but what most academics are doing in a way. Because I think it's about finding a balance, right? Because with I think in academic history, we're much more comfortable with just sort of understanding, well, let me read this article that might dissent to what my preconceived notion is with this. But with public history, it is much more consumer driven in the sense of you can do the most nuanced museum exhibits you want. You still have to get the people in the door before you can try and present that nuance to them. And so I think whether good or bad, public history, there needs to be a little bit more of an understanding of consumer relations, if that makes sense.
Which brings us to Mount Vernon, I think, because Mount Vernon, of course, is a very successful public historic site, has over 1 million visitors per year. Mm-hmm. How long have you been at Mount Vernon?
I've been at Mount Vernon for 3 years now.
Right, okay. And so how would you, if you don't mind, kind of expand upon that that definition, I guess, or of how you bring the public in. I'm looking at David now, as academic historians, we're sometimes uncomfortable with this language on the market. You used it quite naturally a moment mm-hmm. ago and said, well, we're consumer driven. How do you...
Strike the balance.
How do you strike that balance?
So we are lucky at Mount Vernon in that what many people don't realize is how big the sort of Mount Vernon industrial complex is.
How many people work? I mean, looking at the website, so there's like thousands of people who work there.
At peak season, we have about 500 people on staff.
Jeez.
Now, that's why I say peak season, right? Because a lot of those are spring and summer surge seasonal hires that are coming in to do extra tour interpretation and stuff like that. But so the advantage we have at Mount Vernon, especially after we built the library in 2013, which you can all find out at mountvernon.org/library, shameless plug. What we sort of have the advantage of is that we have an academic staff between the PhD historians we have on staff and our preservation collection folks that are all archaeologists and material culture experts. We can sort of generate the really rich academic detail and then pass that off to our museum studies folks that are a little better at sort of culling that down to, okay, well, if I only have 500 words, how do I tell this story? And then they can hand that over to our new media team to put stuff on the website and do like fun YouTube videos and everything like that. So we have kind of the advantage at Mount Vernon institutionally of, because our staff is so large, we can sort of let people play to their particular skill set and have a sort of economy of scale model that a smaller museum does not have.
So what's your particular role at Mount Vernon?
So I am the digital historian, which even I'm not really sure what that means at times. A lot of what I curate curate and edit our digital encyclopedia that the library maintains, which is like Wikipedia, but better because we actually cite primary sources. And then a lot of what I also do as essentially the on-staff military historian is help consult with any of the different military history-related exhibits or projects that we're working on. So everything from museum labels or exhibit labels in the museum to our new multimedia production we just did, B. Washington, that had two scenarios that were very military history related. I hung out on set for about 2 weeks with all the reenactors, making sure everything was as correct as we could get it. So it's sort of a wide, it keeps me busy. It's never a dull day.
So back to the kind of balance that needs to be struck between the needs of the public or the interests of the public and...
The needs of the many and the needs of the few.
Yes, exactly.
And we're interested in the needs of the few. Right?
Yes, yeah, and academic history. So you're trained as a kind of academic historian, or that's your background. You work in public history. Where a figure like George Washington is concerned, the public you're dealing with is substantial, but also has a lot of well-established views about him. And so while you're attempting to introduce nuance and complexity...
Well, some of them have well-developed views. Some of them are also 8 years old.
Yes, yes. Yeah. That's right, David. Thank you. In fact, that's a particular challenge. Your audience, your target audience has a wide range of views about Washington, ranging from the 8-year old who knows nothing or has seen National Treasure through to people who've read quite widely. So there's a kind of challenge, it seems to me, in how you address that audience, but also you're trying to introduce the kind of complexity and nuance that academic historians who have posts in universities take for granted.
Yeah, no,
how do you do that?
It's a challenge. I mean, in some ways, though, I find I prefer the 8-year-olds because they're clean little slates. I can add all the complexity I want to. I think it's and this is one of the struggles we deal with all the time is how much complexity to introduce to children. And I am definitely the advocate for give them the complexity as early as possible. Even if some of it goes over their head, introduce it. We can sort of clean it up later, but get them used to the idea of complexity because. In many ways, an 8-year-old is less likely to angrily email you after the fact. In general, I find...
They don't use email, they use Instagram, Snapchat.
I get such rude snaps from 8-year-olds. But it is, in many ways, it is the adult audience, and especially sometimes the older adult audience that has grown up with... a certain image of a figure like George Washington that is particularly more challenging to introduce the nuance to, especially when the person that's trying to introduce that nuance to them is, I'm 34, so sometimes, 40 years younger than them, and especially in a political climate that is very hesitant to accept anything that sort of gets castigated as revisionist history. Now, of course, I have the advantage of my entire book is about how, like, every 20 years we completely change our history based off of our politics, and then I can bore them to death with a lecture on that, and then leave a note pinned in their chest about how George Washington actually liked strong federal government and taxation, and go back to my office on a hill behind a gate that's not near where the general public is at Mount Vernon.
Interesting. Can you say a little bit more about the B. Washington exhibit? Because I think that kind of takes us to a lot of some of these issues.
Yeah, so the B. Washington exhibit, some of your listeners might be familiar with a similar model that was done at the George W. Bush Presidential Library when it opened. And it was called Decision Point Theater. And the whole idea was that it would present nuanced scenarios from George W. Bush's presidency and let you sort of receive the information that he received in. But it was only an A or B option. So you would be told, like, the financial markets are collapsing. Do you give the banks money or let a dystopian nightmare occur? Well,
I think I know which one. Nice balanced choice they're giving.
Yeah. It's an A or B. Yeah. So we liked that concept. We thought it could be a great way to create some sort of newfound relevancy and newfound drama for crises from both Washington's presidency and his time as commander of the Continental Army. And right from the start, though, we decided there were going to be three options that we were going to come up with, because we didn't want it to be a bipolar decision-making process, just of yes or no. And then the four scenarios we chose, though, we wanted scenarios that were sort of representative of Washington's career, but then also provided viable options that there could be, right? So that we weren't suggesting any sort of really ahistorical options on the table. So the four scenarios we chose were the Battle of Second Trenton, which is a long story, we won't go into why it's the Battle of Second Trenton, but they wanted a battle scenario, and we had to find one that people probably hadn't heard of. Mm. And so Battle of Second Trenton.
So you're not going to do crossing the Delaware because everyone knows what Washington does there.
Exactly.
Okay.
We did the Whiskey Rebellion, which I know that you all avoided. The Genet Affair, sort of the French neutrality crisis, and the Newburgh conspiracy. Mm-hmm. You know, was there a conspiracy? Was there not? Who knows? But that sort of, what do I do if I'm worrying that the Continental Army might do something crazy? Now, as has already been pointed out to us, there's one scenario that we didn't do, and that involved George Washington's debate over slavery.
Hmm.
And that was for a very specific reason. That was not any oversight on our part. That was like, oh, wait, did he own slaves? I didn't.
I was wondering that.
It was news to me that he owned slaves. We didn't do that for two reasons. One, there was the question of, well, what sort of teaching moment does that give? Because the answer is free the slaves, right?
Mm.
The answer is free the slaves.
Yeah, you don't want to give option A, keep the slaves.
Well, exactly, right? Because
buy more. Yes,
because if we're trying to create a scenario that influences the nuance and complexity of the time, we could do that with the issue of slavery, but we did not feel comfortable trying to offer arguments for why one might keep their slaves. That was just a road we did not want to go down, because the answer should be free the slaves.
It should also be said, I mean, in terms of constructing scenarios, Washington on slavery is actually quite interesting in a lot of ways, but there's no decision, there's no turning point in the same way.
Yeah.
There's no scenario, no one kind of moment where you would say he could have done this or that so much as his is a gradual evolution. At least that's my reading of Washington on slavery. It's a really important question, but it doesn't reduce itself to a scenario with three choices very easily.
Exactly. So that's why we don't shy away from the discussion of slavery at Mount Vernon. We just did, we completely overhauled our museum and exhibit space for an entire exhibit on George Washington's history with his enslaved community. And that's it was launched maybe like 6-8 months after I started working at Mount Vernon, and it's still going on now. So, I mean, that's been a large it's a temporary exhibit, but it was only temporary in the sense that we did everything with that exhibit, and then as that exhibit is rotated out, elements of that exhibit will push back out onto the estate to cover it everywhere on the estate. If that makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think we need to return to slavery.
Yeah.
But let's talk about B. Washington.
But the B. Washington scenarios, the way we constructed them is that you're sort of presented with the initial overview of what's happening and what the issue is. Then you're presented with some different advisors that you can select from. And we intentionally put a time element so that you will not always hear from. Unless you really rush, you won't hear from all the advisors. And we also interrupt you in the middle of it, sort of updating you with current events to where the situation reaches a critical mass and you have to make a decision. And again, what we wanted to do is make it where you will not have complete information because you won't hear from all the advisors. The advisors give you conflicting information. And we took sort of particular, the historians that helped write the scenarios took sort of particularly joy with trying to arrange the scenarios to where you would choose what Washington didn't pick And we don't try and push you to that in an ahistorical way. We just didn't want to lead you by the nose to leading like George, right? We wanted to actually create possibly a teachable moment. And the really neat part for us is that all of the decisions are getting recorded, not by like people's names and stuff, but we will have the back-end data to see, you know, with the Whiskey Rebellion, you know, what percentage of visitors chose to march on Congress or pressure Congress by force, what percentage said buy for time, what percentage did whatever the third option
was. The three options are, because I for those of you listening, you can actually, you know, I was worried you'd have to go to Mount Vernon to play this. You can play it online. So the three options, I think, so for the Whiskey Rebellion were local law enforcement, enforce the tax, or march out there with the army. Which is, I think, you know, thinking about sort of contemporary politics and the kinds of people who are attracted to George Washington sometimes, I think the answer they might want to give is not the one that George Washington ends up with.
Which has been a really interesting point to sort of emphasize to people some of the parts that of George's politics.
So how has the public responded to this exhibition? Have you had?
I mean, it's only been open for like a month.
Yeah, it's only been open for about a month. I mean, it's been getting fantastic reviews from across the board. Everyone from high school students and junior high students that loved it, which was been great, is in the reviews we've gotten from the high school groups. We see that the complexity does not go over their head. They are absorbing it, which we had received some feedback in sort of the design phase of, well, some of these things are a little too nuanced. That, you know, so far does not seem to be the case. It's been sort of, I guess sort of almost kind of feels like backhanded compliments sometimes from some of our friends in more traditional academia with like, wow, that was more complex than I expected it to be. Or you guys, I went in with sort of low expectations, but you blew those away. And you're like, well, thanks.
Actually, if we can pause there for a second, I think that's really interesting because in our earlier part of the discussion, or in the earlier part of the discussion this morning, you know, I asked you how you relate to the public as a public historian, but the other aspect of that is how do you relate to academic? How do you relate to academic historians? Mm. And I guess put another way, how do they relate to you, do you find?
It's been interesting throughout my career.
You still prefer the 8-year-olds, don't you?
Again, I can
choice between academic historians and 8-year-olds.
I can push them around easier. They have juice boxes. It can be strained at times, depending on who it is, right? Because like I said, at sort of the top of the episode, you know, you there's been sort of some growing pushback within academia of, well, every time I go into the classroom, that's public history. And some of that seems to come from especially folks that work at public universities where they're getting more impetus from their legislators to engage with the public more. They feel like they're being told that they need to engage with the public more because the general public isn't sort of respecting academic opinions and expert opinions on things. And so there seems to be some tension and anxiety there over how does academia, at least in the United States, I can only speak to that, how does it interact with the public? And so the notion that there are some academics with sort of specialized skill sets, or that there's some sort of specialized skill set that's needed that makes one a public historian, I think can become a point of contention at times. I mean, I can tell you that from some folks that are sort of exclusively see themselves as public historians, sometimes they feel a little alienated from academics or more traditional academics because they've, you know, that a lot of their public history efforts aren't rewarded by tenure committees.
I think there's some, you know, one of the things I've noticed is that there have been a lot more universities hiring positions for public historians, you know, especially over the past 10 years. And I think part of that may be because students are looking at the history major, especially in the United States, and say, well, that's awesome, but where's the job? And they think public history is the way to get the job. But then sort of how do you create a public history program from scratch, and how do you get sort of the diversity of kind of talents you need? You know, you can't find necessarily one person who can do, I guess they talk about like four fields in public history. You know, somebody who can do all the things and can do digital history and can do museums and do archives and, so you actually need a team of people to train students, but then, that's difficult. Then how do you reward and promote them?
And that's one thing, again, to any of your listeners that are thinking of going the public history route and want to get, more formalized training, again, it's definitely to look at who the professors teaching the course are and what their background is, mm-hmm. because I know just as a junior scholar that like a lot of my sort of age cohort are landing at their first tenure track position and are being told, well, you're going to teach the public history course so that we don't have to do a job ad for it. And these are people that, through no fault of their own, have no background in it and are emailing myself mm-hmm. and other people that are, active practitioners with jobs in this, asking us, well, how do I design an academic course on this? Because I don't
have taken an academic course on this. Yeah.
Yeah. But they're being told by their department chair that, well, you're the new person, so you're teaching.
This is what the kids want nowadays.
Is what the dean wants, and this is what the students want, and you're going to be the one to do it because we're not going to hire a whole new line just for this. Yeah.
Or if you hire somebody who has experience in, documentary film, that doesn't necessarily mean they understand museums or how those work or understand how digital history works necessarily. So it's a,
So, Joe, let's talk about slavery. Because anybody who's working in public history and in the United States mm-hmm. or with an institution that deals with American history has to confront this challenge, it seems to me, and at a place like Mount Vernon, mm-hmm. That's especially acute because, of course, Mount Vernon was a plantation, mm-hmm. And George Washington owned hundreds
or of slaves. Slave labor camp, as mm-hmm. Peter Wood would say.
So how does Mount Vernon deal with slavery? And as somebody who's worked there for several years, have you been? What surprised you about it? And I guess as a kind of third question, what's the public response?
The public response is always mixed. We are sort of an unofficial way to assess success. Again, this is unofficial, is that if we're getting yelled at by both sides of the political spectrum, we're probably finding a decent balance. Hmm. I don't know if that'll continue work, but that's sort of one sort of...
And is that happening?
Oh yeah, I mean, we hear from some groups that we don't talk about it enough because we only have the one major exhibit, but at the moment we didn't spend the money on signage for All Over because we knew we were going to have to update that anyway. So that's part of a plan, but we don't necessarily release our 5-year plans out to the average visitor. But then other times we get yelled at because we have an entire exhibit about the enslaved. The entire major new exhibit about the enslaved.
Despite the fact they were 95% of the people who lived
exactly,
there.
Exactly, right. So it's one of those, again, sort of jokingly, well, if we're getting yelled at by both sides, we're probably doing something right. And getting yelled at by both sides about the same thing, in a way, right? But just from opposite sides of it. Now, how we try and deal with it is just deal with it up front. That, yes, George Washington owned slaves. That he owned people. That was a bad thing. And let's talk about it in a frank and open manner. What can be problematic for a public history site, and this is where Mount Vernon's size can be a problem for it, and I know Monticello has had this issue as well, and there was an op-ed in the Washington Post a few years back sort of on this particular issue, is that people can mistake the actions of frontline staff as the institutional policy. And what I mean by that is you can mistake a statement by the tour guide, who can be a 60-something-year-old retiree, a white retiree that is uncomfortable with discussing slavery to an African-American audience, and so they try and shy away from it because they feel uncomfortable, as the institutional policy to, no, handle it up front and be open with it. And also,
in fairness to the docent, as people who speak all the time,
it's
ourselves, it's
hard.
It's easy to misspeak occasionally as well. Yeah. So even somebody with the best of intentions
can
misspeak.
Exactly. And a lot of them, get nervous talking about the issue, especially if it's a mixed race group that they're presenting in front of. There's just complications. That's actually when we do our training for our staff. I'd have to go look at the exact breakdown, but I would be willing to say a simple majority, right? Not like 50% plus one, but like a simple majority of our time is probably spent actually on the issue of slavery in one way or another, because part of what they will even receive is a talk about how to talk about slavery and how to gauge, how to make yourself comfortable doing it, because if you're not comfortable, it's going to come off as, or could come off as hesitant or shaky or evasive. And then also at the same time, how to attempt to read your audience to see if you're making them upset in different ways, because we want people to get through the whole tour.
Yeah.
Because if we don't get them through the whole tour, we can't continue to teach them. But at the same time, if you're teaching upsetting topics like slavery, for a variety of reasons, people can be uncomfortable from sort of either side of the perspective. And
it's a challenge. What strikes me about these sites is that people go to them for different reasons. And one of the main reasons people go there is for entertainment. Mm-hmm. It's as much about, the alternative is going to the movies or something. And, it's a slightly more sort of, brand serial kind of entertainment to go to movies necessarily. But, they want to go and have certain kinds of experiences. They don't want to go and feel traumatized when they leave necessarily. And I think some of these, for people who are especially bringing their children to places like Mount Vernon, like their experience when they went 35 years ago is going to be very different, I think, than the experience now. I mean, 35 years ago, they didn't talk about slavery or at Monticello or lots of these other places. And so trying to figure out how to incorporate slavery is profoundly hard. I think particularly of places like, Colonial Williamsburg that has really struggled with how to do it properly, because when they opened, all the living history people were all sort of white actors, and then they finally realized, actually, we have to do some slaves here because that's half the population. But then how do you depict that in a way that is the sort of historical Disney World thing that Colonial Williamsburg is doing, without sort of stripping it of its meaning?
Well, Williamsburg is in a more complicated position because it is an entertainment venue. I mean, more explicitly an entertainment venue. Mount Vernon or Monticello are museums. They're public museums, of course, but
I'm not sure that like people going to these places draw, especially the general public, they don't necessarily find all these nuanced distinctions as quite, that these are old places to see old things.
Right, and somebody on a visit to Virginia may well go to all three places, or it certainly must be common for people to go to Williamsburg and Mount Vernon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at Williamsburg, at one point, they decided to try to, they did it once. They said, well, we had slavery here, therefore we had slave auctions, and they did one slave auction, which, by all accounts, was horrific for both people who are the reenactors, but also for all the people in the audience. And so they said, okay, we're never doing that again. And obviously they're not physically beating slaves or having them actually work in fields. So there's a ways in which they are soft pedaling everything because they have to.
So what has surprised you, Joe, or if anything, in terms of the particularly with regard to the slavery question? Have you been surprised by anything?
Not. I mean, I think because I think I'm not in a unique position, but I think I have the benefit of, since I've been sort of involved in public history since I was 16 in the Deep South.
Right.
You know, I mean, almost every historic site in Louisiana that I ever, because I was always an early U.S. history person, so pretty much every place I ever volunteered at had to confront this question.
Or not confront the question
in some way. I think Mount Vernon does it quite well. I mean, I think it will be interesting. Were either of you at AHA?
Oh, no, I avoid the AHA with compassion because it's...
Yeah, so we went because it was... I went because it was in D.C., so it's right outside of Mount Vernon. Mm-hmm. And there was an entire... There was actually a couple panels on teaching slavery at Virginia, house... Actually, specifically, the presidential house museums, right? How do you balance the great man history with...
Sure.
Look at these horrible things that they were involved in. And I think it'll be interesting... Madison's house is partially run by University of William and Mary.
Yeah, I think that sounds right.
Yeah, and they demoed a new exhibit they were going to have. That connects the slavery at Madison's house all the way up to the Black Lives Matter movement.
Hmm.
And it was very visceral and I think very well done. But I think the question immediately got raised, well, what do you do when the majority of the audience just walks out in the first 2 minutes of this presentation? And since they hadn't actually made the exhibit entirely public yet, they couldn't really answer how they'd handle it. What they were sort of generously saying, well, we wouldn't change it and we just accept that the people... left. Now, of course, it remains to be seen, okay, but what happens if the visitation stops? Yeah. I mean, that's always...
Because you have to make ticket sales to make these things work.
Yeah, I mean, depending on how...
Back to that tension between...
Exactly, for Mount Vernon, because for your listeners that don't know, Mount Vernon is run by the Mount Vernon Ladies Association. It's a completely private organization. They've run Mount Vernon since 1858. And as you can imagine, being founded... or purchasing Mount Vernon in 1858, which is right outside of Washington, D.C., they have had to balance the issue of politics and interpretation at Mount Vernon since the beginning, since they were right on the front lines of the D.C. fortifications during the American Civil War. And so that's why the ladies' policy in general is never to take any form of government money, whether it's state government, federal government, that way they stay out of that divide. They can stay out of the divide of Democrat versus Republican by just sort of not taking any government money. But what it means is we rely entirely on donations from private individuals, but then especially rely on the ticket sales. And, one of the, as we're about to hit, when I get back, actually, I'll be greeted by a long column of buses waiting to get in because we're about to hit peak season for the school tours. And every now and then we sort of rhetorically ask ourselves, what do we do if the buses stop coming? Because to preserve the house and to tell the story of everyone that lived on Mount Vernon, whether it's George Washington or his enslaved community, we need those funds. If we alienate one group, will we compensate for that with another group? Because I think the scenario where we're just going to get everyone there happy, kumbaya, learn a diverse history of the early America is not going to happen quite the way
it's not the way history works.
And I know lots of the sort of plantation houses in the privately owned plantation houses in the South that give tours, don't have the financial kind of resources that the Mount Vernon
exactly.
has. And they have a lot of problems with, what kind of stories can we tell that aren't going to alienate our core base of visitors, which are people who have a sort of gone with the wind, Moonlight and Magnolia's conceptions of what these plantations houses are. They want to see the fancy houses and the dresses, and they don't necessarily, many of them at least, don't want the slave labor camp narrative. You know, and they raise money for these houses by having plantation weddings, and you can have, you know, that's how they pay for their upkeep, which is both horrific on some level, but also understandable on some level.
Although I think Mount Vernon and Monticello in particular are different because of their owners and the subject matter.
And their physical location and all these kinds of things that they're able, they have to deal with it. Whereas some of these other places, you know, they can say, look, oh yeah, there were slave quarters, but they fell apart years ago. We don't know where they were exactly. And they want to tell a particular kind of story because that attracts
people. Well, and that's something I think that the presidential plantation homes have to worry about in particular, though, is that sometimes it can be easier for them to, well, we're going to talk about Tom's time as president or George's time as president, or let's talk about James Madison and the Constitution. They can focus on that story because, well, where else are you going to hear just about the home of, where else are you going to hear just about, you know, this individual figure, right? You know, if you're in D.C. and you want to go to the Woodrow Wilson house, like, they're going to talk a lot about Woodrow Wilson because that's a chance to talk about Woodrow Wilson. You know, but they don't have to mention, you know, Woodrow Wilson not allowing African Americans to work in the federal government at one point. So it's a challenge, I think, for all of the presidential houses in general, but especially the houses that were used as plantations, because where do you draw that line of how much am I talking about here and how much am I talking about what this person did, which is why you actually care about this house, right? If this house hadn't been owned by George Washington, it would just be another Southern plantation home with, you know, 20, 30, no offense to George Mason down the street, but it would be attended about as much as, you know, maybe a little more because it's on a hill in a way that Mason's house isn't. But it would just be another Fairfax County plantation home. What makes Mount Vernon special is that it was George Washington's, right? But at the same time, that's where do you draw that balance of, and it's similar to like a lot of the, I know the way a lot of the plantation homes in Louisiana would sort of avoid the topic of slavery was to really focus on the material culture and the architectural history of the house, which is one way, I guess, to go. If you're into architectural
history, you look at the white spaces, not the black spaces, because the black spaces are often uncomfortable. Not there.
Yeah, or not there at all. Yeah.
Yeah. It's I think these are issues that all these sites are going to continue to wrestle with. You know, I think we've only really started to figure out how to deal with these multiple different narratives, what these spaces are, and figure out how to sort of interweave them in an appropriate way.
Well, that's because the country's still wrestling
with yes. Yeah. When the country figures out this whole race question, I think it'll be a much easier, it'll be a public historian.
Problem solved. Yeah. But it is one, I think, you know, and that's, it's, you know, to go back to what I, you know, how I think Mount Vernon handles it, I think, you know, Mount Vernon and Monticello especially take the leadership at both of those institutions, take it very seriously to handle those questions because they realize they are sort of exemplars in that field and sort of that that type of public history site. And so they sort of extra struggle with it because they know that whatever they do is going to be taken as examples by smaller sites.
And they're under a much greater level of public scrutiny than other places. Well, Joe Stoltz, thank you for your time. It's been fascinating to hear about Mount Vernon and your work as a public historian. I think we can say without hesitation that we would encourage all of our listeners to visit Mount Vernon.
And if you can't visit Mount Vernon, definitely try out Be Washington, and you can role play being George Washington from wherever you are on the globe.
Excellent. All right. Cheers. Cheers, Tim.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.